The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for a special report. The Women Are Here. The United States Golf Association brings the U.S. Women's Open to Pine Needles for a record fourth time. And the cover story article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline. USGA returns to the Sandhills. The world's top women golfers descend on pine needles with forecasts for a robust economic impact. Written by Sugata Mukherjee. Nathan Contenenza can't wait for the week of May 29 to arrive. That's when the United States Golf Association will welcome the world to the sleepy town of Southern Pines to witness the world's finest women golfers compete at the 77th iteration of the U.S. Women's Open. For the 44-year-old executive chef and owner of Ironwood Cafe, the area's largest restaurant that grosses more than $5 million annually, it is about much more than money. We're busy year-round because we have a reputation of serving fresh and innovative dishes, Contenenza says. But when USGA brings tournaments like these to town, the ripple effect is far more than just a week of additional reservations. The entire community gets showcased. Contenenza's sentiments reverberate all across the Sandhills as business owners, civic leaders, and golf enthusiasts agree that major USGA golf tournaments add to the lure of an area known for its quiet and deliberate pace of living, with greens and the equine industry providing the backdrop to a picturesque landscape. Add numerous home rentals, additional hotel bookings, new restaurant reservations, and retail shopping, and Moore County will be buzzing, with the utopic serenity taking a back seat for about a week. Folks in the Sandhills area have been fantastic partners beyond offering the area's pristine golf courses, says Beth Major, a USGA managing director in charge of growing the game through messaging, branding, and communications. We have tremendous corporate support and volunteer participation is great. Companies such as American Express, Cisco, Deloitte, Lexus, and Rolex already have green-lighted USGA's efforts to promote women's golf throughout the world, pledging hefty dollar amounts, but a little-known not-for-profit healthcare entity called ProMedica, based in Ohio, upped the stakes earlier this year when it became the presenting sponsor of the U.S. Women's Open. That resulted in the purse nearly doubling from $5.5 million to $10 million, the highest in women's golf and among the leaders in all of women's sports. The USGA also announced a commitment to raise the Women's Open purse to $11 million and then to $12 million over the next 5 years. This year's tournament will showcase U.S. golfers such as Nelly Korda, Lexi Thompson, and Danielle Kang, all ranked among the world's top 11, and legends such as 10-time major champion Annika Sorenstam, who will tee it up after a 13-year hiatus, Korean sensation Jin Young Ko, ranked number one in the world, and New Zealander Lydia Ko, the world's number three, will test their physical and mental fortitude on the fabled Donald Ross course as well. As stakes get higher, so does the economic impact. We believe the economic impact to the region will top $25 million once everything gets accounted for, says Kelly Miller, president of Pine Needles Lodge and Golf Club. USGA keeps coming back. This will be the fourth time the USGA has chosen the Midland Road course to host the country's top tournament for women. In 1996, Sorenstam, then ranked number one, won the tournament. Australia's Kari Webb came back in 2001 and won the Pine Needles Gathering when she was the top player in the world. And Christy Carr came from behind to beat the world's top-ranked player, Lorena Ochoa, in 2007. These past performances by the winners at Pine Needles reflect a course where the cream generally rises to the top. We're going back to Pine Needles for the fourth time, and that has never happened before, says Allison Burns, assistant director of the U.S. Women's Open, referring to the fact that no other golf course has hosted the U.S. Women's Open that many times. And it may have never happened had it not been for the matriarch of Pinehurst area golf, Peggy Kirk Bell. She's the former owner of the resort and Miller's late mother-in-law. Miller recounts the time in 1991 when Pine Needles was hosting the U.S. Senior Amateur Women's Golf. 2 years after hosting the USGA Girls Amateur Tourney, Peggy Kirk Bell was talking to Judy Bell, no relation, who at the time held an executive role with the USGA. Judy Bell would go on to become the first women's president of the USGA 5 years later. I remember like this was yesterday when sitting at the bar, Mrs. Bell told Judy, "We have had the young kids and we've had the old broads. When are you going to get us the pros?" Miller recalls. Judy looked at her and said, "Peg, if you want the open, you got it." It was really that simple. That 1996 tournament helped change the economic trajectory of the region forever. In 1999, the USGA came to Pinehurst No. 2 for the Men's Open for the first time, and the governing body has never looked back. Ever since, the area has hosted the men's or women's event in 2001, 2005, 2007, and 2014. After this year, the men's version of the tournament comes back to the No. 2 course in 2024, with a pledge to be back in 2029, 2035, 2041, and 2047. In fact, the New Jersey-based USGA is so sold on the Pinehurst region that in 2020 it announced an expansion called Golf House Pinehurst, which will include a new research and innovation facility, along with a visitor center, satellite museum, and offices in the village of Pinehurst. "We will have at least 75 full-time workers at our Pinehurst location," the USGA's major estimates. Meanwhile, the USGA's 300-person headquarters will then be pared down to about 200 workers, Major says. The Sandhill saga continues. Burns, the assistant director of the Women's Open, estimates there will be about 75,000 people descending on the area over the next few days, culminating with the final round on June 5. "We have sold out most of our corporate packages that range from $150,000 to $275,000, Burns said, adding some smaller table packages are still available. North Carolina companies, as usual, played a pivotal role in scooping up the corporate packages used primarily to entertain their clients and potential customers. While the USGA does not reveal the companies that bought these packages, corporations such as PNC Financial Corporation, First Citizens Bank Shares, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, and Duke Energy, among others, have always stepped up in the past to support USGA's efforts in North Carolina. And while patrons start filtering in gradually from countries such as Australia, Sweden, and Korea through Raleigh-Durham International Airport, Pine Needles Kelly estimates most of the crowd is expected to drive down US 1 and other state roads leading to the tournament site and the village of Pinehurst. Resident manager Drew Gross of the revered Pinecrest Inn, located yards away from Pinehurst Resort, says that with the tournament comes the circus, trucks, wires, cables, cameras, broadcasters, and everything else needed to telecast the tournament worldwide. "About 80% of all our rooms are booked to NBC, the television network broadcasting the U.S. Women's Open," Gross estimates. "We will probably do about 150 dinners a night during the week, which is more than 50% of what we normally do," says Gross, adding, "The restaurant could have served as many as 200 dinners for guests every night, but the lack of restaurant workers will likely prevent the lodge from handling the additional business." In the past, Pinecrest has hosted golf legends such as Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, Sam Snead, and many others, but the current crop of top players often stay away from going out as they bring their own chefs and nutritionists to prepare their meals during the week. Economic impact grows. The scope of golf's impact on the region's economy can be measured through canceled tournaments in recent times, and the pandemic sticks out as the most recent example in slapping a value on the impact. In early March 2020, the PGA Tour announced a series of tournament cancellations, followed by major tournaments such as the postponement of the Masters Tournament and the Players' Championship. The economic impact of the Players on the Jacksonville, Florida area is about $150 million. Augusta, Georgia, the host city for the Masters, typically realizes $120 million during the Masters week. Organizers of 7 of the 10 tournaments that were canceled in 2020 initiated their own economic impact study that cumulatively totaled some $550 million on communities. Golf participation was growing anyway, but it was gradual, most golf observers note. But the pandemic certainly changed the dynamic, with golf being one of the few things people could do outdoors after being locked down to prevent the spread of the virus. Ironwood's Continenza adds the $700,000 from the federal government's Paycheck Protection Program allowed him to keep most of his 90 workers during that time. "That was the case across the board for the industry, and it was the only way to keep the workers on the payroll with hardly any revenue coming in," he says. After a slight scale back during the past couple of years, Continenza is back to employing about 70 workers at his restaurant, just a couple of miles down the road from the U.S. Women's Open site, and has room to accommodate almost 400 diners each day. Having the U.S. Open in town gives us a great boost as a community, he says. This adds to the lore of the area, and the visitors will leave with experiences that will benefit the entire region for years to come. At a wine event in Raleigh just a few weeks ago, Carr, who won the U.S. Women's Open last time it was played in Pine Needles, said she was hoping the USGA will offer her a special exemption to play this year. Carr in recent years has fallen down the women's rankings and had to qualify through USGA's qualifying tournament to play at Southern Pines. "I really want to play at Pine Needles. It's a special place," Carr said. Four, please. Now showcasing Southern Pines, North Carolina. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Blue Ridge Corridor to see changes. Major changes are about to happen along the Blue Ridge Corridor as that part of Raleigh finally begins to fulfill hopes that date to when the city planted an arena there in 1999. At a May 24th meeting of the Blue Ridge Corridor Alliance, new details of the new home for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services and the new headquarters for Bandwidth made clear about how much is underway. "A lot is going to happen soon," said Chris Roberts, a principal at the architecture and design firm LS3P. Roberts said the 2,500 DHHS employees on the Dorothea Dix campus must relocate by July 2025 as DHHS moves to a 34-acre site at Blue Ridge and Reedy Creek Roads. This summer, a mail service center at that corner will be demolished. "Then you will really see construction starting to happen," Roberts said. Phase one of the project will be an 11-story, 450,000-square-foot building that will allow for plenty of natural light. Phase two is expected to be a public-private partnership with a developer that would be another office tower of roughly the same size, pulling in another 2,700 DHHS employees scattered across the city, Roberts said. Phase three would be a land lease for the remaining half of the property, which could include high-rise development along Blue Ridge Road. "It's such a great site, right in the heart of everything," Robert said. "What the site is doing is really going to be transformative." The 40-acre Bandwidth campus, meanwhile, will add more than 1,000 workers to the corridor. Scott Lahr of Gensler, who has worked with Bandwidth for 2 years, noted, "Part of what drew Bandwidth to this corridor and this area is all the interconnectedness." The campus will include a Montessori school for children up to 6 years old because, Lahr said, they want the kids front and center. CEO David Morkin believes adults behave better when kids are present. It's all part of a dramatic surge of interest in a part of Raleigh where development has lagged. V Foundation adds cancer expert. The V Foundation for Cancer Research has added a new name to its C-suite as Dr. Susanna Greer was appointed as Chief Scientific Officer. In this role, she will work with the organization's Scientific Advisory Committee to direct funding to researchers at cancer centers throughout the country. Greer will help lead the organization's efforts of tripling its fundraising goals over the next decade. Since its founding in 1993 by former NC State University basketball coach Jim Valvano, the V Foundation has funded about $290 million in cancer research grants. Greer had been the senior scientific director for the American Cancer Society. Greer also previously was a Georgia Cancer Coalition Distinguished Cancer Scholar at Georgia State University, where she directed the university's Molecular Basis of Disease program. WakeMed lauded for maternity care. WakeMed Health and Hospitals recently received a big honor when it was ranked among the best maternity hospitals in the U.S. in a recent ranking by Newsweek. The rankings came from a national online survey from Statista, which crunched data from hospital managers and healthcare professionals and other key performance indicators when it comes to maternity care. WakeMed, across its campuses, delivers about 8,600 babies each year. "More than anything, these awards recognize the WakeMed team's deep commitment to delivering the best possible experience for every mother, baby, and family," said Dr. Chris DiRienzo, WakeMed's chief medical officer. "Congrats, and now back to the scramble for infant formula." Supercomputer analyzes water. A Texas supercomputer has shown all those lessons about the importance of sharing from kindergarten were right. A new study of the Triangle water supply shows that regional cooperation can lead to more effective use of a region's water resources. David Gorlick, a postdoctoral research associate at UNC Chapel Hill, teamed with David Gold, a PhD candidate at Cornell University, to study how agreements between water utilities can mitigate risks. They analyzed the water systems of the Triangle and used a supercomputer at the University of Texas to run vast numbers of simulations. We found that cooperation amongst utilities could be beneficial to both their water supply and financial needs compared to more traditional independent planning and management, Gorelick said. The study also found that less flexible arrangements between utilities could mean more risk. Cooperation, Gorelick said, is a good thing. Ocracoke is a number one beach again. The beach at Ocracoke is again ranked the best in the country in an annual review by Stephen Leatherman, who goes by Dr. Beach. Leatherman rates beaches around the world in his annual review of America's best beaches, often has Ocracoke near the top. Last year, the Ocracoke lifeguarded beach was number three, behind number one Hapuna Beach State Park in Hawaii and Cooper's Beach in Southampton, New York. But Ocracoke does have a home court advantage. Leatherman grew up in Charlotte and earned a geosciences degree at NC State University. And finally, in a section called He Said It, a quote from Greg Haddam, founder of Empire Eats, on the reopening of the Mecca restaurant in Raleigh. Everything is looking the same, tasting the same. It's amazing. And now we turn to the On Echo Devo and Aviation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, Battery projects target Eastern North Carolina site. Kingsborough Megasite is located only 15 minutes from I-95. Thousands of jobs have long been envisioned for a site in Eastern North Carolina. Now that vision could be closer to reality. A top economic development official confirms five or six major projects are eyeing the site, including multiple firms tied to battery manufacturing for electric vehicles. Norris Tolson, CEO of the Carolinas Gateway Partnership, says he doesn't yet know the names of the half-dozen companies he's negotiating with for the Kingsborough megasite near Rocky Mount. Right now, they're all operating under code names, but they all have something big in common. They're looking for shovel-ready sites. The megasite is a 1,449-acre advanced manufacturing site located just 15 minutes from Interstate 95. I'm reasonably confident that we'll land one of these projects if they are, in fact, looking for a ready-to-go site, Tolson says. We certainly fit the bill. Up until recently, the site was technically on hold as Chinese tire maker Triangle Tire had already announced plans for an 800-job operation in 2019. But as Triangle Business Journal reported in March, Triangle Tire told officials last year the project was unlikely to happen over geopolitical issues. Officials have been quietly marketing the site to other manufacturers. In May, they got the official all-clear from Triangle Tire, which transferred the site back to local officials. Tolson also says that means negotiations can be expedited. Depending on which project, they range anywhere from a few hundred jobs to a few thousand, he says, noting that a couple of the firms interested could bring between 2,000 and 3,000 jobs. All would be very large investments, Tolson says, and the majority are in electric vehicle batteries. As you know from the Toyota project, they are very large projects, very, very large investments, he says, referencing the Toyota battery project that's planned for the Greensboro-Randolph megasite. Potential EV opportunities are not limited to Edgecombe County. As of May, the state had 30 automotive projects in the pipeline, according to Christopher Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. North Carolina confirms losing Hyundai project to Georgia. After weeks of speculation, car giant Hyundai Motor Group has announced plans to invest more than $5.5 billion in an electric vehicle and battery manufacturing facility in Savannah, Georgia. Hyundai considered North Carolina before picking Georgia for the project, expected to deliver 8,100 jobs. Yes, we were engaged with this project, says David Rhodes, spokesman for the North Carolina Department of Commerce. The firm appears to have looked at both megasites in Chatham County, Triangle Innovation Point, and Chatham-Siler City Advanced Manufacturing Site. We spoke with a very similar project for both TIP and CAM, says Michael Smith, president of the Chatham Economic Development Corporation. The Hyundai project had the codename Project EA with the Commerce Department. Smith says their project had the same codename. RDU hits pandemic milestone. Traffic is coming back at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, at least 85% of it. That's according to CEO Mike Landguth, who briefed the board during the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority's May meeting. The airport is at 85% of 2019 traffic levels, Landguth said. For April, RDU reported just over 1 million passengers, a 65% increase year over year, and the highest monthly count since the pandemic began. So far in 2022, though, through April, RDU has hosted 3.3 million passengers, up 92% from the same period in 2021. And in a section called She Said It, a quote from Jessica Joyce, SmartWire's Senior Vice President of Americas, on relocating the company's headquarters from California to Durham. We're really excited to tap into the local universities. And finally, a big number, 68. The number of times Sean Good, a former Morgan Stanley advisor, accused by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission of orchestrating a $5 million Ponzi scheme in North Carolina, invoked the Fifth Amendment in refusing to respond to allegations that he used client money to pay back other investors, as well as on personal expenses such as a Porsche Boxster and European vacations. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page, written by Zach Ezone. Locus Biosciences raises more capital. Biotech adds $35 million for clinical development. About 7 months after securing a $25 million credit facility, a Morrisville biotech has raised another $35 million. With these two sources of funding, plus annual revenue in the $30 million range, Locus Biosciences is advancing its clinical development and pursuing merger and acquisition opportunities. That's the three-legged stool, CEO Paul Garofalo says. We're leaning on partnerships and assets to build a company that's able to operate smoothly as we grow. Investors that participated in the round include Artis Ventures, Tencent Holdings, Viking Global Investors, Johnson & Johnson Innovation, and Discovery Innovations. The funds will support Locus as it advances its lead asset into a Phase 2-3 study this year. This candidate, called LBP-EC01, is a precision medicine targeting E. coli bacteria causing recurrent urinary tract infections. Locus is developing this asset through a $144 million program with the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, an office of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Additionally, Garofalo says the company plans to advance a second asset into a Phase 1 study this year, and in 2023, the company hopes to move two preclinical programs into the clinic. By 2023, we'll have four clinical stage assets, he says. We're already a clinical stage company, but advancing into latter stage clinical trials is always really exciting. Locus is developing these assets on its own and through partnerships. In addition to working with BARDA, B-A-R-D-A, the company in 2019 entered into an agreement with Janssen Pharmaceuticals and its parent company, Johnson & Johnson, potentially worth up to $818 million. Locus is developing drugs for respiratory and bloodstream infections under this agreement. Locus is also inked a deal with the organization Combating Antibiotic Resistance Bacteria Biopharmaceutical Accelerator, or CARB-X, to develop LBP-KP01, a drug candidate targeting Klebsiella pneumoniae, a bacterial pathogen. According to terms of the deal released by the firm in 2020, the contract will provide Locus $2.05 million initially and up to $10.5 million over 3 years. That funding should be enough to finance both the preclinical development and Phase 1 clinical trials of the drug. Raleigh Biotech targeting cancer raises $37 million, plans hiring spree. A biotech firm in Raleigh has raised $37 million to further its efforts developing multiple cell and gene therapy platforms targeting difficult-to-treat cancers. The company, Inceptor Bio, announced May 19th the close of its Series A financing round, which Raleigh-based Kineticos Ventures led. The money will support the preclinical company's manufacturing and research and development efforts. Triangle Biotech veteran Shalish Mangi founded Inceptor in 2020 to pursue cures to one of the most complex medical problems in society, cancer. The company is advancing this effort through the development of cell and gene therapies, which the CEO says represents the next wave of drug development. We're in the early days of a 50-year run that will change the medical field, Mangy says. Following its launch, Inceptor raised $26 million in a seed round last year, which supported the company's early efforts to assemble a team, license technologies from universities such as UNC Chapel Hill, and build out manufacturing capability. North Carolina leads hospital safety rankings. Collectively, hospitals in North Carolina are among the safest in the country, according to the latest report from a nonprofit focused on healthcare consumers. Nearly 60% of hospitals in the state, the highest percentage of all states in the U.S., earned the highest marks possible in LeapFrog's Spring 2022 report released earlier this month. The organization measures hospital performance and issues biannual safety grades. This also represents an improvement from the state's 2021 fall rankings when 55.1% of hospitals in North Carolina earned an A grade, ranked number 2 behind Virginia. And in a section called She Said It, Humacyte CEO Dr. Laura Nicholson on the company's first shipment of investigational engineered blood vessels to hospitals in Ukraine to treat civilians and soldiers who have sustained vascular injuries. Humacyte is proud to contribute to the ongoing Ukraine medical relief and to support the patients and the brave medical providers on the ground during this humanitarian crisis. And finally, a big number, $37.6 million. The amount Durham Diagnostics company Baby, spelled B-A-E-B-I-E-S, recently raised from 87 investors, according to a May 3 filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The company is looking to raise a total of $50 million in the offering. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Brumette. Smaller grocer may fit for Carrie's Fenton. Carey Project may take option 2 as anchor. Tenant remains elusive. The town of Carey has approved an option 2 for the development team behind the Fenton mixed-use project along Carytown Boulevard, allowing for a smaller grocery store space and an additional building up to 14 stories in height. The original plans, now dubbed option 1, show a 100,000-square-foot anchor space initially claimed by Wegmans. The New York grocer pulled out of its plans in early 2021, and a new grocery tenant has not yet been announced. The developers, Hines and Columbia Development, are approved to build either option and have not yet decided on which plan will come to fruition. In option 2, two buildings and a parking deck are in the area where a large grocery store would be in option 1. One of the buildings is listed as a smaller anchor by the town and would be one or two stories with the option for a pharmacy drive-through on the side of the building. The other is a vertically integrated mixed-use tower between 4 and 14 stories tall. The development's planned 175-key hotel was slated to be next to the original grocery anchor space. Option 2 shows that building in a new configuration, but still beside the unfilled anchor tenant spot. The unnamed hotel could land in the newly added tower instead, but Paul Zarian, managing director at Houston-based Hines, says it most likely will not. Zarian declines to say if there are any more deals in the works with a specific hotel brand or a grocer. For the smaller anchor space, grocery is still the preference, he says. In a misunderstanding in November, Carey Mayor Harold Weinbreck posted on his blog that the new grocery tenant would be Publix. Weinbreck later removed the statement after being told by the Fenton team that Publix landing in the development was a possibility, but not a done deal. Weinbreck told Triangle Business Journal in an email. The Florida-based chain has opened multiple stores in the Triangle recently, including a location in Wendell Falls in December. That store is two stories and features a drive-through pharmacy window. Circus restaurant to close after 48 years. After nearly 50 years of serving hot dogs and hamburgers, the Circus Family Restaurant in Raleigh is closing up shop. The colorful eatery has kept its circus-themed decor and menu of sandwiches, fries, and milkshakes intact since it opened in 1974. The restaurant will be closing for good at the end of May due to staffing challenges, a common theme in the hospitality sector. Glenn Mitchell, the restaurant's owner, began working at the establishment in 1986. Ever since COVID-19 began, I can't find enough people to work, Mitchell says. Closing is the only option. The Circus Family Restaurant is located at 1600 Wake Forest Road, easily identifiable by its yellow, red, and green exterior. The building sits between Wake Forest Road and Automotive Way near Capitol Boulevard. In the past few years, the area has seen a spike in new development. Publix coming to New Raleigh Retail Center. A vacant 24-acre lot in Northeast Raleigh is set to become a new retail center. Plans have been filed with the city for a 72,000-square-foot shopping center at 5100 Forestville Road. The site is slated to have four buildings, with Florida-based Publix anchoring the center in a 47,000-square-foot space. The property is owned by four LLCs affiliated with Development Management Incorporated of Charlotte, Blue Ridge Companies of High Point, Yearns Properties of Greensboro, and NAI Southern Real Estate of Charlotte. Caldwell Rose, president of NAI Southern Real Estate, says the group is currently under contract to sell the property. Site plans list Halverson Development Corporation, based in Boca Raton, Florida, as the developer. And in a section called He Said It, a quote from Paul Gagné on his new position at the Farrington House Inn and Restaurant. Gagné is taking over as executive chef after serving as sous chef to Colin Bedford, who was at the restaurant for 16 years. "We're looking at service in general and ways to modernize it without losing the Farrington feel." And finally, a big number, $6 million. The amount Tri Point Homes paid for 20 acres of land near the intersection of Guess and Lado Roads in Durham. The developer will build up to 200 townhomes. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. And first we start with the column written by David Heinen, who is the Vice President for Public Policy and Advocacy for the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. The headline, "Nonprofits Prepare for Downturn as Economy Could Face Recession." With staggering inflation and recent declines in the stock market, nonprofit leaders are bracing for the possibility of a recession. Based on recent history, a recession could mean a prolonged period of hardship for nonprofits. During both the major recession from 2007 through 2009 and the brief economic downturn at the start of the pandemic in 2020, recovery came much more slowly for nonprofits than for the economy as a whole. Nonprofits business model. To understand the way an economic recession affects nonprofits, it's helpful to know a bit about nonprofits' business model. At the most basic level, nonprofits operate with three key principles. Nonprofits provide programs and services to meet areas of need within their communities, not for the purpose of making a profit. This means that nonprofits typically offer services below cost and often for free, and that they provide more services at a greater financial loss when needs increase. Nonprofits operate with an expectation of a balanced budget and make careful plans each year to generate enough revenue to pay for the amount of services they expect to need to provide. Nonprofits' main sources of operating revenue include a combination of fees for services, for example, child care fees, health insurance payments, and tickets to art performances and exhibitions, government grants and contracts, individual and corporate contributions, and foundation grants. For most nonprofits, contributions from government, foundations, and individual and business donors are essential to making up the difference between the cost of providing services and the income derived from fees for service. And no one owns a nonprofit, but rather they are required by federal law to reinvest any excess income back into their missions. Ideally, nonprofits have some years with a bit of extra revenue so they can build up financial reserves as a rainy day fund that can cover several months of operations in years when revenues are down or demand for services is higher than expected. Impact of recessions. Economic recessions often include a combination of inflation, high levels of unemployment, and stock market declines. Each of these factors can take a significant toll on nonprofits' operations and finances. Inflation creates two major challenges for nonprofits. First, more people turn to nonprofits for basic services like food, rental assistance, subsidized health care and child care, and job training when their income doesn't keep up with the sudden increases in the cost of living. Second, rising prices of gas, food, and supplies also increase nonprofits' own operational expenses. From an economic perspective, inflation increases both the number of people that nonprofits must serve and the cost of providing services without creating any new revenue opportunities for nonprofits. As with inflation, high unemployment rates create increased demands for many services provided by nonprofits as more people turn to nonprofits to help cover their basic needs. And when more people are out of work, state and local governments typically have to cut back on their grants and contracts to nonprofits to offset lower than usual income tax and sales tax revenue. Often, nonprofits will also have to lay off some of their own staff during recessions, even while taking on more services. This could take a toll on remaining nonprofit staff and on volunteers. Additionally, staff layoffs can create steeper and more immediate unemployment expenses for nonprofits than for businesses. Frederick to replace Edwards at Marbles Kids Museum in Raleigh. It's a new direction for the Marbles Kids Museum in Raleigh. The board has named Jonathan Frederick the new CEO to replace Sally Edwards, who led the museum for 15 years. For more than a decade, Frederick has served as the director of the North Carolina Science Festival, a core initiative of UNC Chapel Hill's Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center that engages 500-plus organizations statewide across economic sectors. As a Triangle resident, I have long admired Marbles Kids Museum's deep work in the community, offering child-centered, play-based learning experiences, and am eager to help grow Marbles as a shining example of how our community cares about children and their families, Frederick said. He will join Marbles at the end of June. Todd Boyette, the director of Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center, said, Jonathan's strongest quality is his ability to innovate and create. He's a big thinker, but more than that, he pulls together the people needed to execute the big ideas. And in the nonprofit briefs, realtors help provide AC units to those in need in Wake County. Wake County residents in need of free fans and air conditioning units as the summer hits can get relief from Cool for Wake, a seasonal weather relief program supported by members of the Raleigh Regional Association of Realtors, or RRAR. The program runs from May to September, and eligible community members, seniors, the disabled, and homes with children can get help within 24 hours of notification. The Cool for Wake volunteers usually visit 160 homes and deliver an average of 20 air conditioning units. Members of RRAR volunteer to deliver AC units to homes in need within 24 hours of notification. Qualified residents have never had a delivery take longer than 24 hours during the span of the project. It's important that we have always been able to meet the demand for our neighbors in need, said Denise Kissel, the volunteer and university relations coordinator for Wake County Government. Golf tournament raises money for children's charities. The Accreditation Commission for Healthcare, or ACHC, hosted its fifth Chipping In for Charity golf tournament May 16 at the Briar Creek Country Club in Raleigh. Since its inception, the event has raised close to $170,000 in total for two local charities, Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Triangle and Safe Child. We are grateful to our sponsors and the individuals who participate in ACHC's charity golf tournament, said Jose Domingos, president and CEO of ACHC. After a two-year break due to the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic, we feel deeply motivated to renew our corporate social responsibility efforts by maintaining the growth of this philanthropic event to support charities that do so much for the youth of our community. And finally, Better Business Bureau honors students with scholarship awards. The Better Business Bureau of Eastern North Carolina has awarded $20,000 in Torch scholarships to a number of college-bound students in the 33-county area it serves. The winners were recognized at a ceremony April 22 at Prestonwood Country Club in Cary. Honored at the event were Cary Brown of Clayton, $1,000, Allie Chandler of Cary, $1,000, Carter Lampson, Greenville, $1,000, Brian Vasquez, Anger, $1,000, Rylan O'Connor, Raleigh, $1,000, Chloe Alston, Wake Forest, $2,000, Gabriella Luperlo, Apex, $3,000, Hector Lopez, Wake Forest, $5,000, and Noah Civiletti, Chapel Hill, $5,000. And now we turn to the continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. The headline, Scaling a Business, How Two Marines Formed Triangle Rock Club and Built Their Climbing Gym to Now Include 5 Locations and Expansion in Another State. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ plus community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project will also delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. 10 years in the Marine Corps, including 6 in Force Recon, taught Andrew Kratz everything he needed to know to build a successful indoor climbing gym. Starting a business isn't unlike the military. You're very independent. You make decisions on the fly. Variables are constantly being thrown at you. There's a lot of risk management, and the stakes are high. All the same stuff you have building a business, explains Kratz, who discovered his passion for rock climbing while in the military. It was mildly dangerous, adventuresome, and exciting, all the reasons I joined the Marine Corps packaged up in a sport. In 2007, when he and co-founder Luis Jag Jiregu, a fellow Force Recon veteran, decided to open their first Triangle Rock Club in Mooresville, the business model for indoor climbing gyms was nothing like what they envisioned. Contemporary climbing gyms with colorful, comfortable settings didn't exist. Typically, it was a warehouse on the wrong side of town with 24 to 30 foot ceilings, no air conditioning, and a feeling of exclusivity, Kratz says. If you weren't already into climbing, the gyms of yesteryear were not the place to start. Triangle Rock Club is the antithesis of that motif. Their gyms exist to share the fun of climbing fitness with anyone interested. The way we approach it is that this is the opportunity for everyone who's never climbed. The only precursor is that you come in and try it, he says. There are classes to get people started, meet-up events to build a sense of camaraderie and community, and all levels of opportunities. One Triangle Rock Club member is in his late 70s and still climbing, and children as young as 4 come with their parents. What the military taught me was to have persistence in overcoming obstacles, Kratz says. A lot of businesses don't succeed, not because it wasn't a great idea or there wasn't a market for it, but because they hit an obstacle and couldn't see a way to get over it. Starting an indoor climbing gym was a great idea, but a risky one. He and his wife moved from Virginia to the Triangle in 2007 with their 2-year-old and a newborn, but no friends or family locally, and no concrete business plan other than to find a central location to open a gym. The Morrisville Club opened 7 months later. My buddy Luis and I went in together, 50-50. We scraped up as much cash as we could, did a friends and family round of investing, and talked a bank into lending 2 novice business owners the balance, Kratz says. I was selling our story, selling Luis and me, and I followed my dad's advice about financing. It's the same advice he'd give to other startups. Find a community bank and work with somebody local, so the person you're talking with is the one who is going to be authorizing the loan. If you're just a number on a file in another city, it's going to be a tough sale to get a loan approved. We worked with Ken Atkins at Crescent Bank, now First National Bank, and they bridged the balance of what we needed. Initial startup costs were roughly $500,000, but it was a sound investment. Within about 3 months, the gym was turning a profit. The long-term plan envisioned an expansion of the Mooresville gym, but that was the extent of their growth strategy. As the indoor climbing concept gained purchase in the market, the vision grew. In 2013, a 17,000-square-foot expansion was completed in Mooresville, and the second Triangle Rock Club opened in Raleigh. The following year, they expanded into Fayetteville, and in 2018, they opened Triangle Rock Club in Richmond, Virginia. 2019 was another banner year with the opening of the Durham Club and the completed expansion of their Richmond location, both of which were shut down within months of completion due to COVID restrictions. From March 2020 until May 2021, the clubs in North Carolina could not operate at full capacity, although the Richmond facility resumed full operations by the end of 2020. Plans for expanding the Durham facility also ground to a halt during the pandemic. Here's a weird factoid. We're getting more financial help in 2022 than we did in 2020 or 2021 just because of the timing when the aid is received, says Joel Graybeal, who has managed financials and led business development since coming on board as a managing partner in 2012. The company received $1.03 million in PPP loans, about $550,000 in employment retention credits, or ERCs, and participated in the state's MURR, Mortgage Utility and Rent Relief Program, a value of $40,000. Ironically, Graybeal had attended the club's first introduction to rock climbing class when the Mooresville location opened. A former banker at First Tennessee Bank, he developed a quick passion for rock climbing, a friendship with the owners, and a commitment to see the business prosper. We have this business model where we go into a building, get the club running, build our climbing community, and have the facility laid out so we can expand, Kratz says. It worked in Mooresville and Richmond, and now it's playing out in Durham. where construction has resumed, and the $3.7 million expansion will bring new 47-foot climbing walls, an additional 17,000 square feet of rope climbing terrain, and a 2,500 square foot fitness area and yoga studio. In Durham, members are here for bouldering because we don't have the tall walls yet, but when we open the expansion in another 2 or 3 months, there will be a whole new clientele coming for the ropes, and we'll be a destination gym, pulling people from Greensboro and Winston-Salem, he says. The current rate of 400 to 500 check-ins a day at the Durham Club is expected to scale to 700 to 800 check-ins daily. Supply chain bottlenecks that slowed the expansion are gradually improving. The walls are made in Bulgaria, and our first container arrived today after being delayed by more than a month because of the Ukraine issue, Kratz says. Both the walls and the Bulgarian crew that assembles them were on site by mid-May. Staffing has been a challenge, but not as bad as for other industries because the people who work here have a passion for climbing, Graybeal says. That's true for all of the staff, whether it's a member of the route-setting team, climbers with an artistic mindset who work full-time reinventing the color-coded routes every 6 to 8 weeks, or the executive leadership like company president and chief operating officer Mike St. Laurent, who showed up as an 18-year-old kid when the first club was being built and volunteered to help. It's that connection to the staff that Kratz thinks about when private equity investors approach him with an interest in the company. We've been engaged a couple of times, but we're still having fun and we have a close connection to all of our staff, he says. We've been very intentional as we grow to invest in our staff and put them in leadership roles. If we sell to PE money, I wouldn't have an ability to protect them at that point. Kratz has a similarly protective and pragmatic approach to the company's position in the Triangle. We'd be foolish to think we're always going to have this market to ourselves, but we'd also be foolish to think that we can't adequately serve the community here. If a competitor facility opened next to one of our locations tomorrow, what would we do differently to keep our members? Whatever that is, we should be doing that now. That's the way we run the business. Whatever we do to respond and serve the community then, that's what we do today. And we also have two short news articles in the 52 Shades of Success section. NEA research reveals fewer low-income rentals. According to research from the National Equity Atlas at the start of the pandemic, there was not a single state, region, or county in the U.S. where a full-time worker earning minimum wage could afford a two-bedroom rental home, and nearly half of Black and Latinx renters, more than one-third of all renters, were paying unaffordable rent. From 2013 to 2019, the NEA research showed that 81% of the 100 largest metros in the U.S. experienced a decrease in the housing options that were affordable to low-income renters. As of 2019, Black households could afford to rent in only 7% of zip codes in the 100 largest metros, and Latinx households could afford to rent in only 16% of those zips. By comparison, white households could afford to rent in 69% of zips across the 100 largest metros. North Carolina's major metro areas are among those with declining rental options for low-income residents. From 2013 to 2019, the share of zip codes affordable to low-income renters dropped from 34% to 10% in the Charlotte Metro, from 37% to 16% in the Raleigh Metro, and from 38% to 18% in the Greensboro Metro, NEA data reveal. Ocean City Beach added to North Carolina Civil Rights Trail. The Ocean City Beach community is being honored with a marker on the North Carolina Civil Rights Trail for its role in the state's civil rights history. When it was founded in 1949, Ocean City was the only place in the state where African Americans could purchase coastal property. It is also the location of the first Black-owned fishing pier in the state on the site of the former U.S. Navy Operation Bumblebee Observation Tower. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Naming Rights for PNC Arena is up next. Who wins? As the Carolina Hurricanes make a valiant attempt to repeat what the team did back in 2006, which is to win the Stanley Cup, their home could soon undergo a name change. Sources say PNC Bank has put forward a proposal to extend the 20-year, $80 million naming rights deal struck by the former head of Canadian Bank RBC and Gale Force Holdings, then led by Peter Carmanos. That naming rights deal was set to expire at the end of August. PNC would continue to pay the $4 million and make an upward adjustment to the annual payment based on the cost of living expenses and current inflationary pressures on goods and services. As part of the original agreement, the deal, which was broken down into two 10-year periods that triggered an annual payment of $360,000 to NC State University, $1.3 million to the Carolina Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon-led entity, and about $1.5 million to the Centennial Authority, landlord of the arena. The authority members represent Raleigh, Wake County, and North Carolina state government. Cutting an extension deal with PNC now offers Dundon some breathing room to shop the naming rights package to companies in and outside the area. Some insiders who are versed on the naming rights process say Dundon's ask for the next multi-year deal is $7 million to $8 million annually. That would be a big increase from $4 million. Much has changed since the last naming rights deal was made. The Hurricanes have a new owner in Dundon. RBC sold its U.S. operations to PNC Bank, and the population around Raleigh, Durham, and neighboring counties has almost doubled, and far more growth is on the way. The naming rights business has changed dramatically in the past decade. The splashiest entrants in the naming rights marketplace are crypto companies. To say Crypto.com's 20-year, $700 million naming rights for the former Staples Center in Los Angeles is big is simply an understatement. Then came FTX's $135 million deal to name the Miami Heat Arena. Sources say Dundon and his team in the past year have visited local companies such as computer giant Lenovo, Advance Auto Parts, and national crypto entities that were having a remarkable run on Wall Street until last month. But if crypto sponsors are Dundon's yardstick, he is going to be very disappointed. The crypto market crashed earlier this month. It has recovered some, but it is very likely the volatile marketplace will have a lot of companies out of business when the dust finally settles. With tech stocks down to levels not seen since 2010, any naming rights deal will come under scrutiny by the board. There are other issues that need Dundon's attention. He needs to work with Centennial Authority to convince Raleigh and Wake County to support a new round of debt service for about $100 million in PNC Arena upgrades. For Raleigh and Wake County, it could be about $10 million a year until the debt is paid off, almost double what the county city officials were paying in debt service for the past 20 years. And with the gambling bill standing a good chance of becoming law, Dundon could parlay the naming rights deal with the sportsbook franchise he wants to build on the parking lot of PNC Arena. Dundon thinks his power play is well-timed, PNC continues with its naming rights deal for a couple of more years, enough time for Raleigh and Wake County to decide whether to support the upgrades. If everything falls in place, Dundon has a vastly improved facility to showcase for a new naming rights deal. The number in Dundon's mind is simply unlikely to work for PNC, Lenovo, Advance Auto, or any traditional company, I think. But maybe Dundon has a sweetener up his sleeve to make the deal work. We shall see. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page with an article written by David Pertell. Triangle Landmark's new look, luxury Kimpton Hotel to replace Raleigh's iconic Holiday Inn. Plans for the luxury hotel that will replace the iconic Holiday Inn building in downtown Raleigh have been revealed. Kimpton Hotels and Restaurants, part of IHG Hotels and Resorts, recently announced plans for a boutique hotel scheduled to open in 2025. The hotel will be part of a new mixed-use development plan for property on the 300 block of Hillsborough Street. Tidal Real Estate Partners of New York acquired the property in late 2021 and later unveiled plans to redevelop the site. The 20-story development also calls for high-end residences plus restaurant and retail space. The new Kimpton in Raleigh will be owned by Tidal Real Estate. It will span the first six floors of the building and feature 179 rooms, including approximately 20 suites. The new building, designed by architecture firm Earl Swenson Associates of Nashville, Tennessee, will sit at the corner of Hillsborough and South Dawson Streets. The hotel will include three unique restaurant and bar concepts, according to Kimpton. That includes a rooftop bar and lounge and more than 6,500 square feet of meeting and event space. The hotel will also have a 24-hour fitness center. The interior design is being led by INC Architecture and Design, based in New York City. This will be the fourth Kimpton Hotel in North Carolina, joining the Kimpton Cardinal Hotel in Winston-Salem, Kimpton Iris Hotel in Asheville, and Kimpton Tryon Park Hotel in Charlotte. The circular Holiday Inn building is set to be demolished. Site plans that Title Real Estate Partners filed with the city earlier this year show a 697,655-square-foot building spanning both 300 Hillsborough Street, currently a surface parking lot, and 320 Hillsborough Street, where the Holiday Inn stands. The plans show the hotel portion of the project facing Hillsborough Street and the residential side of the building looking out over East Edenton Street with a total of 350 units, 281-bedroom units, and 72-bedroom units. The planned parking deck would have 447 parking spots. More hotel rooms in downtown Raleigh is something local officials have been pushing for. The city has restarted an effort to bring a potential 500-room hotel downtown to serve the Raleigh Convention Center. Durham Industrial Space sells for a combined $72 million. This is written by Cliff Barnes. A real estate investment company in Chicago has purchased industrial space on either side of South Miami Boulevard in Durham County for a combined $72 million. LaSalle Investment Management, an independent subsidiary of Jones Lang LaSalle, bought 23.79 acres at 4001 Stirrup Creek Drive for $49.9 million in late April from Link Industrial Properties of New York City, according to Durham County Real Estate Records. That 208,800-square-foot property houses one of 70 East Coast locations of the Maryland-based Capital Electric, which provides electrical products, lighting, and services mostly to contractors and builders in Georgia, Maryland, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. Capital is a division of the Sonepar Group, headquartered in Paris. The building on Stirrup Creek Drive, built in 2017, has an assessed value of $15.58 million. The property sold for $17.2 million in 2018 and $1.4 million in 2016. LaSalle also bought 9.6 acres at 4102 South Miami Boulevard for $22.25 million from Link Investment, which is also known as Link Logistics. And finally, United Therapeutics gets long-awaited FDA approval, written by Zach Ezone. Competing drug companies in the Triangle are pursuing new treatments for pulmonary arterial hypertension, and one just received approval from federal regulators. United Therapeutics on May 24th announced the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved the company's dry powder formulation of inhaled treprostinil called Tyvaso DPI. United Therapeutics, with a sizable operation in Research Triangle Park, is planning a commercial launch for the product next month. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.